Hasidic, Hungarian, Los Angeles. Need I go on? This plethora of different groups and different ideologies and different shades of performance can lead to considerable disorientation, confusion. I want to offer you a single distinction, a single pair of categories which divides the field in what I think is the most fundamental issue. All the rest is minor variations. I call the two categories traditionalist and not only traditionalist, with hyphens. Not hyphen, only hyphen, traditionalist. I know the latter term is a very ugly, long, clumsy term, but it says what I want to say, as you'll see. What I want to do is first describe the two categories to you, and then offer some remarks on the possibility of dialogue, and then offer some historical observations, and I hope there'll be some time for questions. Those who are burning to continue the conversation can do so at 4:30 upstairs in the library with me. A traditionalist is someone all of whose Jewish practice, all of his Jewish belief, all of his Jewish identity comes only from the historical tradition. The only source of any Jewish information, Jewish direction, Jewish values, Jewish priorities comes from the historical tradition. From the Bible, from the Talmud, from the Midrash, from the Zohar, from the legal compilations, from the philosophical works, from the ethical works, commentaries, and the continuous Jewish experience throughout the millennia. Nothing else is relevant to any aspect of his Jewish identity. It's conceivable to have a person whose Jewish identity is not his totality. He may think of himself as a person who does various things because he's Jewish, and he does other things irrespective of his Jewish identity. Whether that's really a genuine position or not, I'm not going to debate this afternoon. So I'm making it a slightly weaker proposition. I'm not taking positions either way. I'm the stronger proposition. Whatever he does as a Jew, he does because of the tradition and only because of the tradition. The other category, not only traditionalist, is a person who wants a positive relationship with tradition. Now, this, what I'm going to tell you now, is so surprising and so unlikely to come from someone dressed like me. I'm going to say it three times. I've had very bitter experience with people who just don't hear what you say. They only hear what they expect you to say. Every Jew with a Jewish identity wants a positive relationship with the tradition. Everyone with a Jewish identity wants a positive relationship with the tradition. There's no one who's anti-traditional. No one. Not even the most left-wing reform is anti-traditional. Because to be anti-traditional is to opt for Christianity or for scuba diving or climbing Mount Everest. If a person calls himself a Jew and wants to have any kind of positive Jewish identity, he can't be anti the tradition. That's inconceivable. So everyone wants to have a positive relationship with the tradition. Only, in this second category, that's not all they want. In deciding what shall be their Jewish identity, their Jewish belief, their Jewish expression, practice, Jewish activity, the tradition plays an important role because no one is anti-traditional. But other things also play a role. And because other things also play a role, they may be forced on occasion to decide what they want more. Do they want the tradition to determine this aspect of their Jewish expression? Or do they want something else to determine this aspect of their Jewish expression? So maybe the tradition versus Greek philosophy, or the tradition versus Roman politics, or the tradition versus Parisian fashions, for the tradition versus feminism or democratic values or whatever you like. And then, when pushed to the wall, they may decide on the basis of those other considerations what their Jewish identity shall entail. Now here's an example of an actual historical case, which I think was misunderstood very widely in the traditional camp as to how the not only traditional camp functions. About 15 years ago, the conservative movement debated whether or not women should be accepted as rabbis. It was 20 years ago now. I'm not interested in the reasons for it again. That's not my subject. I'm a logician. My subject is the method of making the decision. Now what they did was, they assigned the Talmud faculty of the Jewish Theological Seminary to research the subject. Can women as rabbis be reconciled with the tradition? These are conservative rabbis, students of the Talmudic sources, read and interpreted from their point of view, and they came back with a report that it's impossible. It's impossible to reconcile with the tradition. That was stage one. Stage two was they opened the question to the entire faculty of Jewish Theological Seminary, including psychology department and the history department, the literature department, and all the other departments that they had. And they took a vote, and this time the vote was in favor of allowing women to become rabbis. And that became the official policy of the movement, though there was a small breakaway movement that still opposes it to this day. Now, traditionalists who viewed this misunderstood the logic of the situation, I believe. And this is what they said. This is a clear example of hypocrisy. First you assign the Talmudic faculty. These are the competent experts. These are your scholars of the traditional sources. They tell you it can't be done. Then you open the question to people who are trained in literature or psychology or history who have nothing to do with the relevant sources. They're completely irrelevant to the question of principle, the question of Jewish law, whether or not a woman can be a rabbi. And then you decide on the basis of these irrelevant experts how to deal with an issue where the relevant experts already told you that it's not possible. Isn't that clearly hypocritical? The answer is no. It is in fact clearly not hypocritical. It's just a question of understanding what the right methodology is. Because their methodology automatically has two stages. The first stage is, let's see if we can reconcile it to the tradition, because, as I've said now for the sixth time, everyone wants a positive relationship with the tradition. Everyone. If they could argue that it was justified on the basis of the tradition, that would be the best of all possible solutions for them, because that's what they want. Okay, their experts said it can't be done. That doesn't close the issue for them. Now the question arises, shall we change the tradition? That for them is an option because they are an NLT group, a not only traditionalist group. The tradition is important, but it's not the only factor. Now who should be consulted in the decision to decide to change the tradition? Not only the experts in the tradition. That question could be raised to anyone. Anyone with a good command of any subject and a knowledge of what's going on in the world has a relevant view on whether or not the tradition should be changed. That's why they opened the question to the entire faculty of the JTS. And when the faculty of the JTS as a whole voted that that women should be accepted as rabbis, then the acceptance of that policy meant we have decided in this case to change the tradition. There's no hypocrisy there whatsoever. It's just a consistent application of the NLT methodology, of the NLT position. So this is the difference between the two categories. Let me point out that the possibility of dialogue between the two categories, as I've described them, possibility of dialogue is not great. Because in discussing any issue of Jewish substance, the two categories have different methodologies. They recognize different sources as relevant to the issue. And therefore, the discussion is not going to be conducted on agreed upon foundations. It's a little bit like setting up a chessboard with chess pieces on one side and checker pieces on the other side. In the middle of the board, you're going to have chaos. So, the question of who is a Jew, or the question of what one's relationship to Israel comes up, or one's relationship to our non-Jewish neighbors comes up. And the traditionalist says, the only thing that's relevant to me is the Bible, the Talmud, the Midrash, Maimonides, the Zohar, only the traditional sources. And the NOT representative says, wait a moment, what about Aristotle? What about Shakespeare? What about American constitutional law? What about Kate Milligan? I mean, to the NOT representative, any and all of these can be also relevant to his Jewish identity. And to the traditionalists, they have nothing to say. They're not part of the tradition. So it's going to be impossible to have a substantive discussion between members of these two groups on a subject of Jewish significance. Unless there's one way out. Unless the NOT representative will voluntarily agree not to use all those external sources that he thinks are relevant. He could do that. And then you could have a kind of sparring match, you know. I'll pretend to play your game, the NOT says. I'll pretend to play your game and restrict myself only to your sources, just to explore your view. But he's not given a chance to express his genuine view, because his genuine view depends upon the external sources as well. So his real view never gets on the table. You can call it a discussion if you want, but it's not a dialogue between two people who are representing their true views and putting them on the table for discussion. Beyond that, discussion is going to be, I think, impossible. Furthermore, even within the NOT category, discussion is going to be difficult. Because each NOT representative can choose whatever particular external sources he thinks are relevant, and they won't agree with one another on what sources are relevant. So, for example, about 20 years ago, there was an animated exchange between the conservative and reform movements about the definition of who should be a Jew. How should you conduct conversion? At that time, I understand it's deteriorated since then. But at that time, I think the majority view in the conservative movement was that if a man wants to convert, he should be circumcised, and both the man and the woman should go to mikveh, a ritualarium, the place where you do rituals, a ritual pool of immersion. And he or she should commit to keeping those commandments that the conservative movement regards as essential. Reform said that to be recognized as converted to Judaism, you pay your dues to the local Reform synagogue, saying I'm in the list, and that's enough. No beliefs are required, no commitment to practice is required, certainly no circumcision, and certainly no ritual pools. So the conservative movement accused the Reform of emptying conversion of all its content. The Reform response was, you've maintained 85% of the traditional formula. We've maintained 5% of the traditional formula. You haven't accepted the traditional formula as it stands. You changed it as suited you. We've changed it as suited us. Who are you to throw a brick at us? And frankly, I think that the Reform gets the better end of that exchange. Once you decide to change the traditional definition on the grounds of what appears to you to be more important, you lose any leverage to tell anybody else that they shouldn't change it differently from the way you change it. Becomes now a matter of free choice for every group to do as they please. It should also be pointed out that in this free choice, every group, so far as I know, every group does have standards. Sometimes the competition is painted as the exclusivists or elitists versus the inclusivists or Democrats. As if to say, the traditionalists draw lines, set up barriers, build walls, and wall people out. And not only traditionalists are open and inclusive and tolerant and welcoming. But the truth is that if you have a group based on any common ideal, any common standards, then you're going to have to draw a line and exclude somebody somewhere. For example, there's a congregation in Cincinnati called Beth Adam that was expelled from the American Reform Movement about 8 years ago, 10 years ago. This was depicted in a magazine called Reform Judaism. And the reason for it was this. At Beth Adam, what they did is they rewrote the prayer book, the Reform prayer book. They rewrote it, excluding all references to God. What does Beth Adam mean? Beth means house of, right? Adam means man, right? That's what they called it, Beth Adam, house of man. And the Reform movement expelled them on the grounds that Reform Judaism requires openness to the God concept. And this congregation is not demonstrating openness to the God concept. So they're out. I'm waiting, this may actually have happened, but if it hasn't, it certainly will happen soon. I'm waiting for a Jews for J, or Hebrew Christian congregation, to apply for membership in Reform, or some other not only traditionalist umbrella group. And when they're challenged to say, you're really Christian, the answer will be, listen, we observe the Sabbath on Saturdays, and we have a Passover Seder with three matzahs. You can imagine who the three matzahs stand for, can't you? Right? But I'm not joking. They actually do this. They actually do this. Right? And we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Now, most of the people in your group don't do any of those things. In fact, you tolerate in your group people who don't believe in God at all. Well, what are you going to say? It says in your Bible that God didn't become a man? It also says in your Bible that God exists. You're tolerating people who don't believe in God at all. What have you got against people who think God became a man? Where do you draw the line? The answer will be, we draw the line in Christianity. That's where you draw the line. You have to maintain your religion as a separate religion. But they too will say no. They will draw a line and say no. So it's not a question of being inclusive versus being exclusive. Everybody's exclusive. The question is, how exclusive are you? Let me point out also that when you cut your traces with the historical tradition and you try to set up policies, the policies often become either arbitrary or very crassly self-serving. Reform has complained that the Jewish tradition is unfair to men. What? What did he say? Unfair to men? Can't be. He must have meant women. I'm sure he meant women. No, I mean unfair to men. Because the Jewish tradition says that you are born a Jew if and only if your mother is Jewish. Your father is irrelevant. Now, clearly, that's not fair. Shouldn't men get equal representation? And don't let anybody tell you the fairy tale that this is because your mother is an observed event, and therefore it's objectively decidable who your mother is, and the father is not objectively decidable. And that's why the Jewish identity went through the female line and not through the male line. That's what they tell their 10-year-olds, but by the time they're 12 years old, they can figure out that that's wrong. Because tribal affiliation goes only through the father, not through the mother. Which means that the Messiah, who must be a direct descendant of King David, goes down only the father's line, which is not observable, right? And not decidable by observation. And the priests are determined only by the father's line. So who the Messiah is and who the priests are is pretty important information for running the Jewish people. Had it been crucial that identity should be observable by birth, then everything would have been done by the mothers. And it isn't so. So that's not the right reason. At any rate, so what did Reform do? Reform said, we're going to change it and give men equal status. Now, if you think about it, changing it to give men equal status could be done in a variety of ways. You could require both parents to be Jewish. That would make them equal. You could require 3 out of 4 grandparents to be Jewish, irrespective of sex. That would make it equal. You have quite a variety of options here. How do you think you should pick which option is the best to make the men equal? The answer is very simple. You want to have a maximum number of Jews to support your sagging movement, so you make it as loose as possible, and you make it either parent. It doesn't help, because 3/4 of the children into intermarried families end up without any Jewish identification whatsoever. So it's not really building up the roles. But this is what happened. When you cut yourself loose from the tradition and try to make a decision, the decision is made either entirely arbitrary terms, or it's made in very crass, self-serving terms. Okay, now, I want to comment a little bit on the nature of the traditionalist movement. People ask, if the traditionalist movement is so severely limited to a particular train of literature, and limited to a particular continuous historical experience, why is there such vast differences between subgroups in this category? Such vast differences of practice and priorities and belief and commitment. If they really are limited in this way, shouldn't they be uniform? This question is based simply on a misunderstanding of the facts. First of all, many differences that you observe between, let's say, Yemenite Jews and Polish Jews and Jews from Los Angeles. Well, I'll be there in February and I'll check for myself. Many of the differences are customs. And the Jewish tradition encourages each local community to develop its own customs. And that being the case, there's no controversy here. There's no schism here. Oh, the New York Times loves this. You know, there are no warring sects here, as you find in the New York Times religious pages. There's simply an encouragement of each group to organize its Jewish life in terms of customs in the way that it finds convenient. So, in a Sephardi synagogue, you have those beautiful metal cases for the Torah, which are put on the table and read vertical. An Ashkenazi synagogue, the Torah is read horizontal. When I go into a Sephardi synagogue and I'm offered an aliyah, I take it, and I make the blessing on the Torah vertically. When a Sephardi comes into my synagogue, he makes the blessing on the Torah horizontally. Because this isn't a matter of law, it's a matter of custom. So much of what you see in terms of differing practice is really just a matter of custom, in which case there's no difference of opinion, no implied friction whatsoever. Secondly, there are differences of opinion in Jewish law, and sometimes communities accept one authority or another, and therefore one community will follow one authority, and another community will follow another authority, where each community recognizes that the other community's authority is a genuine authority, and therefore what they are doing is done appropriately, only this community doesn't do it. So, for example, Sephardim cannot eat most Ashkenazi meat. Because some 800 years ago, there was a controversy as to what counts as a lesion on the lung, making the animal treif, and the Sephardi world in general took the more stringent position. And the Ashkenazi world in general took the more lenient position. And therefore, a Sephardi cannot eat in the home of such an Ashkenazi. Now, what's the attitude of the Sephardi? Ha! You Ashkenazi, you're going to hell! Because you're eating treif meat! No, that's not his attitude. His attitude is, my community chose the stringent authority, your community chose the lenient authority, both authorities are genuine authorities, and therefore you have every right to do what you're doing, and I have every obligation to do what I'm doing. So when there are differences in law, that too should not be assimilated to the New York Times trivia and thought of as schismatic divisions and warring factions and competition over the truth and all the rest of that kind of nonsense. That's simply not true. That covers about 98% of the differences that you find between groups. Furthermore, when there are the few really difficult divisions, divisions of principle where each side declares that the other side is wrong, capital W, there, the experience of the Jewish tradition shows us that after a while, there is usually consensus. There's what I call historical closure, which I think is quite surprising, and therefore I'll give you a few examples. Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed was burned in Paris by the local rabbi as a work of heresy. Here's a case where they were not willing to say he's an equal authority. They said he's a heretic. They burned it in public. Now, that could have led to a schism. Maimonidean Judaism and anti-Maimonidean Judaism. It could have. And in other religions, matters like this did lead to permanent divisions. And at that time, as I mentioned the day before yesterday, you have Jews scattered over thousands of miles of the Earth's geography. There's no central authority. The yeshivas in Babylon have long since disappeared. And yet, after about 100 years, through the great efforts of Nachmanides, among others, the idea of the Guide of the Perplexed being a work of heresy was dropped. True, many people had objections against it, as mistaken, but mistaken by a great authority, a person with wonderful mastery, just to disagree. So the issue of Maimonides came to a historical closure. Similarly, Maimonides started a trend with his Mishneh Torah of writing books of legal decisions without any argumentation or sources. When he wrote that book, there was tremendous opposition. They felt it would destroy the study of the Talmud. And he didn't write the reasons for any of his decisions. He just wrote the decisions blank. There was tremendous opposition. You could have had a schism into Judaism with codes and Judaism without codes. Didn't happen. Maimonides won the day. Today, everyone has codes, everywhere. You had the Hasidic movement. The Hasidic movement also, in its inception, generated opposition. There were those who claimed that it was illegitimate in one way or another. And you could have had a schism, as you have in other religions, into Hasidic Judaism and anti-Hasidic Judaism. Today, you still have Hasidic and anti-Hasidic persona schism. Because everyone agrees that the movement, as a movement, is a genuine traditional Jewish movement. That's why you find Hasidim studying at every Misnagdic yeshiva in the world, including the Mir and Panovich and Slobodka and Lakewood. And you find Misnagdim quoting Hasidic sources everywhere. There's no one who won't quote a Pritzadik. There's no one who won't quote a Sas Emes. And why you find the groups intermarrying and eating at each other's tables and diving in each other's shuls. What could have caused the schism didn't. And I think this is important because it illustrates two ideas. Number one, that if there are hot issues today dividing the Jewish world, and there are, I would say the hottest, the one that generates the most bitter opposition between groups is Zionism. One shouldn't jump to the New York Times conclusion that we now have a break into warring factions of Judaism. Maybe wait another 50 or 100 years. The historical closure will take place again, as it did over those bitter issues in the past. If history is any guide, and as Santayana said, those who are ignorant of history are condemned to repeat it. If history is any guide, we should expect that closure will come. And secondly, I think we should note that closure under these conditions is not expected. Something very strange is going on here. A group without any central authority, a group living in vastly separated areas, under very different host cultures, it would be natural for them to develop different priorities, different approaches, different methodologies, different values to a certain extent, and then that should generate different forms of practice. And they should become enshrined as permanently different forms of practice. If that didn't happen in our history, it is a very surprising fact, one which I think requires some considerable investigation. At any rate, I think that should hopefully reduce the impression that the traditionalist category is subject to wild and bitter differences of opinion over fundamental issues. Occasionally, you do have a particular individual who excites this kind of controversy. There was considerable suspicion that he was really a Shabtai Tzvinik for decades. But there again, the ranks closed eventually. And today, there's no one who holds out that he was a Shabtai Tzvinik, Chas V'Shalom. Shabtai Tzvi himself managed for a few decades to confuse and to convince a considerable amount of, especially the European rabbinate, that he was a genuine Messiah. But they were much farther away, so it was easier to fool them. But there again, after a few decades, the ranks closed. You don't have 30% of world Jewry still waiting for Shabtai Tzvi to come back. So these matters, which are very controversial in their times, our history tells us that if you wait another 50 years, the issue will collapse, one way or another. So I think that the question of the continuity and the uniformity of the traditionalist group is one that can be defended. Final remark, and then I'll take your questions. Considering what I said 2 days ago, it should be clear that only the traditionalist group can claim continuity with the last 3,000 years. The NOT group, by definition, is using whatever external matters appeal to it in order to override the tradition when it feels that overriding the tradition is necessary. Now, every group that has done that in the past has disappeared. Of course, there are people who don't care about disappearing. If this is the way I live my life, what do I care if my great-grandchildren live like this? That's a position that one, I think, can take. But if one is looking for a way to link to the mystery behind Jewish survival, if one thinks that 3,000 years of consistent thought and practice mean that there's some special reality here, then aligning with the NOT category is not going to do it. Okay, questions?
Talk about schisms within the traditional groups. You can't comment on Chabad.
I did. I said that even when there are individuals, and I named two, about whom there is considerable controversy as to whether or not they are kosher figures, whether or not they are acceptable figures, after some decades, there is historical closure. And I gave one example on one side and one example on the other side, didn't I? I mentioned Shabtai Tzvi and I mentioned Rav Yonah Shnaibshes. Right? And that's exactly what I was alluding to. Yeah.
Do you feel that the traditional movement really stays to 100%?
Nothing stays to 100%. The only thing that stays 100% is God. Everyone fails and every group of people fail, and but I said what their principles are. I don't know if you were here for the very beginning. Yeah. The definition of a traditionalist is a person for whom only the tradition is relevant in expressing his Jewish identity. That's the only thing that's relevant. Of course, he may make mistakes in understanding it and applying it. That can happen to anybody. But that's all that's relevant. He's not willing to consider anything else in deciding any aspect of his Jewish identity. Yeah.
Did Christianity start with the sect?
Well, yes. It did start off as a sect of Judaism by cutting its traces with certain elements of the tradition, and then they accelerated that. Now, exactly what is that relevant to?
No, so they've cut themselves off and formed a completely new religion.
Correct.
Which you're saying. You're saying that when people cut themselves off and make differences, so then it comes back together as a unified mass, which didn't happen.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. No, I was trading on what I said 2 days ago. I remember what I said 2 days ago, the difference between the variety of Christian groups and the variety of Jewish groups. Right? The situation in Judaism is unlike the situation in any other religion in the world. There are no Reformed Christians. There are no Reformed Buddhists. There are no Reformed Muslims. All the Christian groups believe that they are following the original tenets of the religion. And the others have gotten it wrong. The others have misinterpreted it, misunderstood it. There's no one who says, we all agree on what the original tenets are, but we don't like them, and we're changing them and overruling them. There is no such comparison. Now, when I talked about continuity, I'm talking about within the traditionalist category. Only within the traditionalist category. I was responding to someone who would say, if you have all the same literature, all the same methodology, all the same experience, how come there are such wide differences? Within the traditionalist category, you have this historical closure. Those who step outside the category, of course, there's no closure for them. They disappear. Yeah, in the back.
Is it true that Reform movement decided all you need to do is to pay dues to become a Jew?
The truth is, sometimes they'll do it without the dues also.
I mean,
there's no formal requirement.
There's no formal requirement?
No.
So what is the Reform movement considered to be a Jew?
Anybody who says he's a Jew. Anybody who claims to be what?
I'm sorry,
it's confusing. We're talking about conversion. Oh, okay. Not born as a Jew, but we're talking about conversion. Right? To convert as a Jew, is come in and say, I want to be Jewish. Some may require you to study certain matters, and some may not. It all depends upon the taste of the particular rabbi.
I mean, there's no papal figure in any sect, any branch.
There's no what, sorry?
Papal figure, like central authority, other than like. Esteemed rabbis of the day, right? I mean, like, what I'm asking is this true for every reform, every conservative, every...
Let me give you an example. Maybe the condition of the situation is not really clear. About 8 years ago, a document came out with the official principles of conservative Judaism. A friend of mine showed me the chapter on the origin of the five books of Moses. Sorry?
Who wrote it?
The central body of conservative movement. The chapter on the origin of the five books of Moses. This is the official position of the conservative movement. Listen carefully. The official position is some rabbis think God dictated to Moses, and some rabbis think that God inspired Moses, and some rabbis think that Moses' religious intuition is expressed in those books. That's the official position. Got it? There can't be an official position. You can't enforce anything on the conservative rabbinate because it's up to each one to decide what he believes. So you take a consensus and you take a survey, and anybody who represents a reasonable portion becomes part of the... There is, I was told, this was shocking to me. 3 years ago we had a fellow here who was very high up in the conservative movement. He told me that they have a Beis Din. They have a rabbinical court to decide legal issues from the point of view of conservative Judaism. So people send them questions. It's 25 of them. And they debate. Then they take a vote. And everyone's opinion is accepted as right. So if it's 20, I know they changed it. They take 6
now. I had breakfast this morning with the past chair of it, actually.
Yes, that's unbelievable, right? So in those days, if you had 24 voting one way and one voting the other way, they come out with publicizing two right views. The view of the 24 and the view of the one. Now they've made it 6. You have to have a minority of 6 to consider it a right view. You can't enforce anything. It's a movement of people who agree to agree. And that's all there is to it. Right? And Reform is even less. Yeah. Somebody has an answer. Yeah.
You mentioned that the Sephardi groups and Ashkenazi groups, when they have differences in what they find, what they consider as law, they just pick different, or they, it comes from the differencing. A difference of who they pick as the person who is passing down the Jewish law. Now, how would the logic behind someone who's, let's say, Sephardi or someone who's Ashkenazi, who's looking at the other side and saying that they're doing what they're doing, I'm doing what I'm doing, and I don't think they're going to hell, and I think I'm, according to them, they're doing the wrong thing. And how do you, what's the logic of that?
Yeah, it's, you know, what is the attitude that people have when they are scholars and they're investing in a subject and there are differences of opinion? Shakespeare scholars or historians of the French Revolution or whatever. They have a body of material. They've all studied the material and they have contrasting views. So the first thing they'll say is, well, listen, Tom, Dick, and Harry, they're so ignorant, you shouldn't even listen to them. And Peter, Paul, and Mary, they're so, their IQs are so low, they can't think straight. But Henry and George, they're great scholars. They've mastered the material. They each have reasons for their views. Each of their views is a respectable view. Now, I happen to be convinced that Henry's right. Because the way I weigh things up, and the way I evaluate which reasons I think are more important, I decided that Henry is right. But I understand that George is a great scholar, and there's room for debate on these issues. So I've decided for myself what I think is right, but on the other hand, I can't declare that the other side is incompetent in any way. The original authorities who debated these issues had the same attitude towards one another. If the Rambam and the Ravid had the same attitude towards one another, one group follows the Rambam, the other group follows the Ravid, should they not respect one another if the people whom they follow respected one another? So the attitude is, I can do no better than follow an accepted authority. I, being a lay person, a person on, you know, on the average level, what can I do but follow a respected authority? I or my group, my community has chosen to follow this authority. Your community has chosen to follow that authority. Indeed, you are doing exactly what I'm doing. You're taking an authority and following it. So in our methodologies, we are identical. It just so happens that your community has chosen to follow this authority and my community has chosen to follow that authority. How can I have any criticism of you if the methodology on which we operate to make our decisions is exactly the same? So what I say, when I say that your practice is wrong, it's in brackets. According to the standards of my community, your practice is wrong. But then if you ask me to go behind the standards of my community, I go behind mine exactly the same way you go behind yours. We end up with exactly the same fundamental principle. Yeah.
What is modern Orthodox?
Okay, this is extremely important. For me, modern Orthodox is squarely in the traditionalist camp. It's squarely in the traditionalist camp. Why? Because if you ask a modern Orthodox, why does he do X? He will tell you it's in the Talmud, it's in the Code, it's in the Midrash. He will not tell you that it comes from Plato, or it comes from Paris, or it comes from feminism. He'll tell you it comes from the Jewish tradition. He might not be right, but that's not the issue. The issue is not how good is his scholarship. The issue is what are his principles. For me, the traditionalist category is defined by your principles. If your principles are that the only relevant element in your decision is the tradition, then you are a traditionalist, whether your understanding is better or worse. In my experience, modern Orthodox, no less than the most Hasidic, if you push them, if you ask them why they do something, they will, or why they don't do something, they'll often tell you, well, it's only a chumrah, you know, it's only a stringency, you don't have to do it. Now, the person asking the question may be aware that that's not true. But he has an answer from within, not from without. I got this when I was living in Baltimore. And the yeshiva there had a prohibition against students of the yeshiva teaching in conservative and reform schools in the city. There was one synagogue where the mechitza, the division of men and women, was not adequate, wasn't up even to the minimum standards. And yet, boys from the yeshiva taught in their school. So I asked the person in charge of practical halacha in Baltimore, Rabbi Heinemann, how is it that the yeshiva allows him to do that? And he said, you're making a mistake. You're confusing conservative with orthodox with mistaken understanding and mistaken interpretation. If you ask a Jew who goes to that synagogue, why is your mechitza so low? He will tell you, Rav Moshe Feinstein's day, the son of the Brocha, was lenient on mechitzas. We're following his view. If you take out the responsum and actually look at it, you'll see that 60 inches is the minimum, and theirs isn't 60 inches. But they didn't take out the responsum. They didn't see, they didn't look, they didn't analyze, they didn't think it through. That's not conservative. Conservative says, I don't care what the responsum says. We're making it lower because we want it that way. That's different. That's different in principle. Yeah.
So
That kind of leads into what I wanted to ask you, which was, you brought up this theoretical situation where somebody from the NOT group might be able to, or maybe conservative, might be able to dialogue as long as they left their French scholarship and their Aristotle off the table.
Right.
But the problem is that dialogue wouldn't happen because those in the traditionalist camp seem to be saying, well, we're not going to engage in dialogue. We won't appear on a public podium with a conservative. An Orthodox rabbi typically will refuse to be on a public podium with a conservative rabbi in the United States, for example.
Well, I think that's because the only purpose of such an appearance would be where people state their true views and where they actually discuss their true positions. And that can't happen. So then, for this kind of internal examination of the Orthodox view, you'd have to bill it as an Orthodox event under Orthodox rules where nothing other than the Orthodox tradition can be discussed. And then, I don't think the conservatives will want to apply. Right? Because it's not really right for them. It means being artificially crippled in presenting the views that you think are important. So yeah.
I have a question about I'm more confused between traditional and the NOT group. Is the difference in how they believe or how they practice?
The difference is in how they believe, or as I would put it, their standards. But that will have an effect on their practice, of course.
If they believe something but they don't necessarily practice what they believe, still call them the traditional character.
Correct. This is extremely important. For me, a traditionalist is a person who recognizes that the tradition alone is relevant for determining his Jewish practice. That says nothing about how much he's doing. He may have all sorts of reasons that he doesn't, or wants, or can't do. Question is, what determines Jewish practice as a Jew?
Right. Yeah. The other question I have is about an authoritative figure versus a non-authoritative. Like, you were saying, who would be authoritative? So you said that somebody in the general community would accept that this person is authoritative. Okay. Couldn't you make the argument that, you know, let's say the majority of the Jews in the world aren't religious, or let's say a reformed or whatever, and they accept that this reformed rabbi said that he's the next line in the tradition. So the tradition goes like this, and then took a turn this way.
This was fought out. This was fought out on a European train between one of the great Gedolim and a priest, who said, in your Sanhedrin, didn't you decide matters by a majority vote? Yes. Well, we are the great, great majority, aren't we? Christianity over Judaism. Right? And the answer was, it's only majority of the Sanhedrin. Not the majority of the population. In other words, to have a vote, you have to be qualified. Not everybody gets a vote. Now, we're talking about people who represent the tradition. The very first thing should be that they should know it. I mean, know it! Not having taken it for 3 semesters and gotten A's on your tests. One of the reasons that I'm sitting in this chair and not in the conservative movement, with which I was allied for about a year, and not with the reform movement, which I was allied as a child, is because of the poverty of scholarship in those movements. Just plain scholarship. They don't know what they're talking about. I'm leaving out now the fact that some of them lie for political reasons, which is also true. But just plain scholarship. They don't know what they're talking about. This scholarship would not be accepted in undergraduate level of one of our yeshivas. They're just ignoramuses. So they don't even begin to qualify. Let me give you one or two examples. The Guide to the Perplexed, the standard edition today in English, was published by University of Chicago Press 20 years ago, 25 years ago. The introduction was written by Leo Strauss, who claimed to have taught the guide every year for 19 years. He's a professor at the University of Chicago. His introduction is 95 pages. Think of the vote of confidence to this guy that the press gave him to get the 95 pages of the book. Now, on pages 2 and 3, this is what he says. The standard academic view of Maimonides is that he was a conservative rabbi. He broke the law when it suited him. He wrote the Mishnah Torah as a sop to the rabbis, and the guide really shows that he's prepared to break the law when it suits his purposes. And he gives 2 proofs of this, Leo Strauss. One proof is, he says, everyone knows that it is forbidden to examine the reasons for the commandments. 1/6 of the guide gives reasons for commandments. So you see that he broke the law just when it suited him. Now, our great scholar, Leo Strauss, has no footnotes here. Everyone knows it's forbidden to seek out the reasons for the commandment with no footnotes. As a matter of fact, this is discussed in the Gemara in Brachos, and there are a variety of views there. And Maimonides himself, in the legal work, which he wrote as a sop to the rabbis, says twice that it is appropriate for every Jew to seek out the reasons for the commandments. And indeed, there's a gigantic literature on seeking out the reasons for the commandments. Leo Strauss, in another mood, more sober perhaps, surely knew that there's a book called Sefer HaChinuch, which gives reasons for all 613 commandments. They didn't read him out as a heretic. All the commentators do this. Second example. He says, Maimonides writes in the guide that the purpose of Judaism is to eliminate idol worship. That's true. And yet, says Strauss, Maimonides asserts that he read every book on idol worship he could find. Have you got it? That proves that he broke the law. He broke the law because it suited his purpose. Ah, you're wondering, how did the two go together? The fact that Judaism is supposed to wipe out idol worship means it's forbidden to read the books of idol worshippers? I mean, like, what exactly is the connection? Furthermore, the Talmud, which Strauss would have nothing to do with because it's not philosophical, the Talmud says, based on a verse in the Torah, that you're not allowed to learn the ways of the idol worshippers to do them, says the verse in Deuteronomy. And the Talmud deduces, not allowed to learn to do, but to learn to understand you are allowed. And in fact, to be in the Sanhedrin, you had to know idol worship, otherwise how would you try a case of idol worship? And again, no footnotes. Now I have challenged people. This is what you call scholarship? Are you serious? This is a joke! There was a fellow named Ginsberg, around the turn of the 20th century, who wrote that when the rabbi said that you don't rent or sell heavy animals to goyim in the land of Israel, and it's because the animal will work on Shabbos, either they were lying or they forgot the real reason. The real reason is he who has heavy animals can plow land, he who owns land has power, and they wanted to deprive non-Jews of power in the land of Israel. That's the real reason. I put my friends at Harvard, and I said to them, you know very well that according to the Torah, any year in which the Rosh Hashanah comes out on Shabbos, we don't blow the shofar. Because the rabbi said, maybe you'll carry something in a public domain. Doesn't that show you that the rabbis had very extravagant precautions vis-a-vis Shabbos? Why couldn't this be another one of those extravagant precautions? They said to me, you're right, of course, we know that. Ginsberg was a communist! For a communist, everything is determined by economics! So he invented economic explanations for everything. He, of course he's wrong in that. We know he's wrong. But he wrote a very important introduction to the Rishonim, and we still use that. Thank you very much. They know he's prejudiced. And he, Ginsberg, says that the rabbis either forgot or lied on the basis of his commitment to communism. Give me a break. This is not scholarship. This is a joke. It goes with the fashion. No one would do it today because communism is out of fashion. So they'll do it in terms of feminism. Somebody thinks that a woman wrote part of the Bible. Why? Because we're in a feminist era. That'll make his work very popular. And it did make his work very popular. Because that's what people want to hear. What's it got to do with scholarship? I have case after case after case. As an undergraduate, I was taking a course in Biblical Hebrew. In those days, Ugaritic and Akkadian were all the rage. These are the Near Eastern languages that were discovered. Everything in Hebrew was being interpreted. It says, "Vayetze Yitzchak Nesuach Basadeh." I'm only telling you this because you need to know it, otherwise I wouldn't even let it pass my mouth. Isaac went out in the field to converse in the field. Nesuach Basadeh. The teacher that I had as an undergraduate at Brandeis said, according to the latest, I forget if it was Akkadian or Ugaritic, that verb means to urinate. That's what he said. Now listen, boys and girls, this is a verb that's used in the Torah, in the Tanakh. Sicha is a noun, lasuach is a verb. So it has Hebrew cognates in the same body of literature. You don't have to go outside. Furthermore, this is a statement that you don't find anywhere in 1,000 pages of Tanakh. The Tanakh does not deal with that subject. The only example, which is not an exception, is the case where David finds King Saul alone and has a conversation with him, and the question is, why is he alone? How come the king is alone? The answer is he went into a cave to relieve himself. But that's discussing bodily functions in that way. There isn't any mention of it in 1,000 pages of Tanakh. So here, what do you do? For the sake of the fashions of Ugaritic and Akkadian, and publishing your latest nonsense paper, You ignore the fact that it's a Hebrew word with a Hebrew usage in the literature, and you ignore the fact that your interpretation is out of step with 1,000 pages of text, and you want more examples? A friend of mine, Moshe Meisman, did his undergraduate work at Harvard, got his doctorate in mathematics from MIT, and well, he was there, an invited scholar, read a paper on why it is that Hebrew slaves are freed in the sabbatical year. A whole long discussion. In the middle, Meisman raised the hand and said, could you show me where the verses are that says that the Hebrew slave is freed in the sabbatical year? And the guy couldn't find it, actually, so Moshe had to tell him where it was. And he read it, and it says, he's a slave for 6 years, and then 7th year he goes free. And Moshe said, obviously, it's talking about a slave from the time he was bought for 6 years, and 7th year he goes free. Nothing to do with sabbatical year. If you made it the sabbatical year, you could be a slave for 10 years, or 11 years, or 12 years. The guy just misunderstood the most obvious verse and wrote a whole paper to explain it. And read it at Harvard.